This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt
the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, I want to do all the introductions and explain where we're at. But first, I have a quick question just based off a painting that I just ran into in the entryway of the Wild Sheep Foundation. Do wolves get after bighorns?
They do. I think mountain lion and clay mountain lion probably a little bit more of a problem, certainly in the lower 48. But yeah, wolves definitely into thin horn habitat and big time up in BC and in Alberta. But you bet.
It just sure seems like they, I don't know, man, it just feels like a little bit out of their, like that kind of country seems a little bit out of their area of expertise. But they've hit them in the winter or what? The bighorn, like down here in the lower 48 in the winter?
Well, they'll hit them different times of the year, but yeah, absolutely. Further south, desert bighorns, as Gray just referenced, mountain lions are a little bit tougher on sheep than wolves. But yeah, it's a tough place to make a living.
Have there been cases where Mexican gray wolves have killed desert bighorns? Do they know about that yet?
You know, I don't have any documentation of that. I have not heard that, but I'm sure they would.
Yeah. Man, it seems like a formidable, like when you factor the topography and then just like the horn structure and stuff. Well, just seems like a formidable foe.
It they really are. If you look at the way the animal is built, you know, the way their eyes are positioned on their heads. If you look at these mounts in this room, just look at, you know, how much they see.
Eyes bugging out the side of their head.
You know, their greatest defense. They see a long ways, a lot further than we do. If you look at the country in which they live, it's the topography's tough. There's always escape terrain and places for those animals to escape. So, you know, they've survived. They've adapted and learned to deal with predator issues through time, but yeah, it's tough.
There's a guy, I can't remember his name, a professor at University of Alaska at Fairbanks, and he wrote a natural history book about Alaska, and in it he talks about an eyewitness account of a friend of his who watched a single lynx chase a doll ram down a gully, jump on its back, and kill it with a bike to the base of its neck.
Yep.
A lynx, who's like a snowshoe hare specialist.
Well, it's not just the four-legged predators either. You have eagles and other things. In fact, I've observed firsthand golden eagles. I was hiking an area one time working with sheep, and overhead I saw a lamb go by.
No, really?
Oh, yeah. So it's not just the four-legged predator.
Wow.
That's pretty nuts. I heard that they kill them, but I didn't know they carried them off. I thought they just like ran them off, like somehow scared them or spooked them or ran them off ledges and then killed them. Well, like that.
Yeah, I observed it firsthand. They pick them up. You know, they're small.
Yeah.
Tiny animals.
Just a little lamb.
Yeah, exactly.
We watched a golden eagle spend 20 minutes working over a bull elk.
There's two golden
eagles. Yeah, working over a bull, dive bombing his head.
And you could tell this bull elk did not like it.
He was agitated, man.
I've flown surveys and almost had them land in the helicopter with you, and they are huge animals.
All right, so we should probably, so like I said, we're at the, you guys call it the World Headquarters?
World Headquarters of the Wild Sheep Foundation.
World Headquarters, Wild Sheep Foundation, Bozeman, Montana. Still in Bozeman?
Still in Bozeman.
It's Bozeman.
Yeah, this is Bozeman. It's almost Belgrade and almost Four Corners, but it's Bozeman address.
So if I write you a letter, I put Bozeman.
You put Bozeman. Yeah.
Let's go around and do introductions. We'll do it like I like to do it as though I'm dealing cards, and so you're up.
Garrett Long, so I'm the marketing and communications director here, exhibits and sponsors manager, store manager. What else, Gray?
You clean toilets.
Yeah, clean toilets on a frequent basis. And I came over here just recently, about 3 months ago. I previously was the conservation leader over at Sitka Gear, just down the road, and came over here to just do real conservation work, and it's been a blast. I mean, it's been pretty cool.
So you guys probably have a – you probably had a relationship with this organization when you were there, because I know Sacred does a lot of stuff in support of
– Yeah, so my job there was actually kind of inverse of what it is here. I took in all the contracts, conservation contracts, and decided what we spent money on, prioritized conservation organizations. So it was great actually coming to the Wild Sheep Foundation, because they were one of the groups that I use as an example, you know, going through like 990 forms and things like that with other organizations, like, hey, this is what we're looking for. These are the type of projects we want to fund, all that kind of stuff. So it was pretty cool getting the call from Gray, but yeah, I had worked with them a lot. And then I still work with them over there a lot too, because they support us very heavily.
That's great.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
Clay Brewer, I'm the Bighorn Program Lead, Conservation Director for the Wild Sheep Foundation. I worked for almost 30 years, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, did a lot of things, was the bighorn, mule deer, pronghorn guy for years, served in various leadership roles, actually served as the interim wildlife director for a year and a half, and so my experience, I have primarily on-the-ground experience. I'm not necessarily enamored with these sorts of things that we're doing here today. I've spent my life out in the middle of nowhere, and I enjoy that aspect of it. So I spent the majority of my career restoring sheep, bighorn sheep in Texas. They were extirpated by about 1960. And so through our efforts that
we've
done
there.
They
hung out as late as 1960?
Oh, yeah.
And then got extirpated.
The last documented sighting of a native Texas bighorn occurred October of 1958 in the Sierra Diablo Mountains, which is a little bit south of the Guadalupe Mountains.
Usually when we're talking about something vanishing, it's 20 years earlier.
Now, it was 1960 was what we guess, anyway. So after that... lots of work, lots of transplants, lots of things going on, but bighorn sheep are at late 1800 population levels right now.
Was anybody, okay, in 1960 in Texas, after the last one vanished, was it, what, a day later they started recovery? I mean, were they already paying attention to it as they were on their way out?
Well, there was a guy hired in the 40s. And this is a guy by the name of Birch Carson. He was hired to document the decline of bighorn sheep in Texas. And so today, well, I'll give you my experience. I was a younger guy then and was hiking through the mountains. And was actually, we did and still guide all of our own sheep hunts. So I was preparing had a sheep hunter coming here.
You mean the state guides?
State of Texas, yes.
And you guys give out how many tags every year?
Well, it varies. Now 15, 16, 17 tags every year, so we've come a long ways.
So if you draw a bighorn tag in Texas, you go out and hunt with you go out and are guided by a state biologist or?
Yeah, well, if you buy a state tag, there are also private landowner tags. That's a little bit different.
Yep.
Some hunters prefer to bring their own guide, which is fine. We like that too. It makes us no difference. But so anyway, you asked me about the did they see it coming, and Texas was no different than the rest of the states where you hear about the domestic sheep issues, and we lost our sheep for the very same reasons. And so a guy by the name of Birch Carson was hired in the 40s to document the disappearance of bighorn sheep in Texas. And so I was getting ready for a sheep hunt, and I was hiking along. It was in January, and it was pretty cool in the mountains. And so I was walking down the ridge, and I decided to get off the ridge, and I started hiking down a deer trail. And so I walked the deer trail for a ways, and I came into an opening, a small bowl in the bottom of these three knobs around, and it got still. The wind stopped blowing, and it got still, and I thought, man, this would be a great place to eat my lunch. Took my pack frame off, sat out on the ground. I looked over on the ground. It said, there was a carving in the rock, and it said W.B. Carson, Sheep Inspector, 1943. And so it became a hobby of mine. I spent a lot of time by myself, and so I started looking for these things, and every time I thought I was the only human being to ever see this, I would look around on the ground, and I would find another carving, and it would say Sheep Inspector, W.B. Carson. And so I found caves the guy lived in. There's a cave in the Texas mountains where the guy's clothes are still hanging in the cave today. And so he documented the decline.
Oh, that's nuts, man. That's like Boone. In Boone's day, they'd always write their names on.
Oh, it's
carve a name into rocks, carve it into trees.
It's interesting history. There's a guy named Bob Anderson, you guys are probably familiar with, Great Rams, 1, 2, 3.
Yep.
He became interested in Birch Carson, and so he actually wrote a book. He's got one. I wrote the foreword for his book, and he never has published it. He hadn't done anything with it, so he's trying to figure out who his audience was, but it's called something like The Desert Wanderer or something like that. So the guy was a taxidermist, and it, just an interesting history. World War II veteran, was injured in World War II and came back and hiked those mountains with a limp. And so, pretty rough country. So short time later, in the mid-50s, there was a cooperative agreement developed between the Texas Game, Fish, and Oyster Commission, Boone and Crockett Club, Arizona Game and Fish Department. I'm trying to remember who else. Wildlife Management Institute. We brought sheep in from Arizona, and in the early years there, in the early 1900s, like most jurisdictions, people focused on protections. There were, like in Texas, 1903, there was a hunting prohibition enacted. And so then in the mid-50s, it was propagation. There's always a joke running around in those days. Most states, the Desert Bighorn Council was formed in the 50s because every state was in the same boat. And some people would have, they only had two sheep left and they knew them by name, and Bob didn't feel so well. It was kind of the running joke. And so propagation efforts were implemented in the mid-1950s, and since that time, 207 wild sheep were translocated to Texas.
Coming out of Arizona.
No, different places. Sorry, and I think I have those numbers wrong. It's more like a total of 107 came from Nevada, 31 from Arizona, 6 from Mexico, and 2 from Utah. So that's the lineage of today's desert bighorn populations in Texas. And so so we worked together. We traded in the early years. We traded Arizona for pronghorn. They were short on pronghorn at that time. Texas had plenty of pronghorn, so we would swap animals. And in more recently, I can tell you, I was at in those days, it was a FNAS convention, and people were coming by my booth from the state of Nevada, and some of them were pretty upset with Texas, and I couldn't figure out why, what the story was, and I thought, man, just having a bad day. And so later on, I was reading a newspaper, and the headlines with letters about 3 inches big said, State of Nevada trades turkeys for bighorn sheep. So the Nevadans were not real happy about that trade. But if it were not for that, then none of us would have any wildlife. As time went on in our case, what's interesting about that is the landowners, we had problems with disease issues in the 30s and lost all of our sheep later on. It was a slow progression. We lost those sheep. And so we worked. Texas is a private landowner state, 97% privately owned, but domestic sheep, landowners raised domestic sheep, and then later on, the very landowners that we worked with that where the problems occurred years ago are the very same landowners that helped us restore sheep today. They're descendants.
Yeah.
And so we did that together. And so, like I say, today we're probably 1,800 animals. So we've surpassed the late 1,800 population levels, and numbers continue to expand, populations continue to grow. And so far, so good. But it only took, 60 years or so, or 70 years, for that to happen.
Start figuring it out.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll dig into that whole story a bunch, man. It's interesting. Then Giannis, of course. Go ahead.
Scott Peckham. I'm the big game ecologist for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon and Southeast Washington. So I work on anything purview of the big game headline, and so wear a lot of hats.
I should tell you all about the elk tag I drew.
That would be good. I heard the rumors
extreme southeast corner of the state.
Okay.
You know it real well? Some waypoints?
I've seen some big animals in that part of the country.
That's what I want to hear.
But I know people that really know it really well. I know the sheep country better than the elk country there, but I do see big bulls in there when I'm doing sheep work. So
you focus on sheep in that area?
Typically, yeah. In southeast Washington, I'm usually up there working on the Hell's Canyon initiative work that's going on.
Gotcha. You back up, like you inform and back up the tribe's perspective on big game management.
Exactly.
And that's interesting because you're actually looking at two different states.
Yes. Yep. Almost three, but yeah, two. Both southeast Washington. So there's three tribes under one treaty. The Walla Walla, Cayuse, and Umatilla. And they're a traditional territory, expanded the state boundaries there. So most of the northern Blue Mountains over towards past La Grande, Oregon, down south towards John Day. So parts of various basins.
So what's your professional mandate then?
To basically protect, conserve, and restore big game populations and their habitat. That's our program mission.
And that's a directive coming from those tribes?
Yes. Yeah. We have a First Foods mission for our Department of Natural Resources, which is fairly well staffed. We have about 100 employees. And DNR itself, our wildlife program is pretty small, about 9 employees. But yeah, under the big game mantra, that's our directive to protect, restore, and enhance habitat and populations.
And I'm guessing you must coordinate with states and Fed?
All the time, yep. Yeah. We work on, because basically a lot of the wildlife habitat where the treaty hunting occurs, where the rights are, or they're allowed to exercise their treaty hunting right, is on federal public lands.
So gotcha.
We work with the land managers of BLM and Forest Service, and then we work with the states, obviously, because they tend to do more of the population level management, so we coordinate with them pretty closely.
Yeah, like the feds are administering a lot of the landscape, but the states are administering a lot of the wildlife on the landscape.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. So decisions about land use and land management planning, we're very involved in that with the Forest Service and BLM.
And you get to spend a lot of time looking at sheep.
I do.
Yeah.
Is that very fortunate.
Is that a high priority?
I'd say yes, just conservation-wise.
Yeah.
The tribe is very interested in expanding populations of sheep. We have a lot of historically good sheep habitat in those parts of the country. I think you've been to Hell's Canyon.
Oh, yeah, but I've gone out looking at bighorns in Hell's Canyon. Yep. Yeah.
And those populations have struggled. So there's a lot of good work that can be done, and so I think that's where our interest is. Obviously, you've probably heard about the mule deer issues that are going on. We do have declines in mule deer populations, but elk are pretty stable, large populations of elk in the Blue Mountains, which you'll get to see. But yeah, sheep is sort of our biggest conservation concern on the big game front.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but is that because things are getting worse or because they could be so much better?
I think in our corner of the world there, we're sort of a stagnant sort of population that has leveled off. So I think there's a lot we can improve. I think we can make some gains for sure.
Gotcha.
For sure. But we haven't had a large die off in several years, but we're only a little ways away from one. We're always on the cusp. So I think there's a lot of work we can do. And this kind of forum is a good place to discuss that.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
Steve Gray Thornton. I'm the president and CEO. We're here, obviously, at the world headquarters, but we also maintain offices in Cody. We have an education coordinator in Nevada. Clay is remote in Texas. We've got a lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and then our Montana conservation director is also in Germany. So we base international operations out of Germany. We work in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan.
Isn't it funny how everyone hates lobbyists, but lobbyists can come from any... Like, people just like are like, oh, a lobbyist, and you register, that must be negative. But to think that there are, like, conservation lobbyists working in D.C., people always envision a lobbyist as, like, some guy out to do something evil, you know what I mean?
Well, he does smoke cigars, so he plays that lobbyist role well.
He's out there lobbying on behalf of wildlife, right?
He is, and he's lobbying on behalf of, wild sheep and wild sheep restoration. But, we called him our advocate and our legislative affairs director. and finally just call me a lobbyist. That's what everyone knows that I am. So, you know, we just cut to the chase, and that's what he is. I was just back with him 2 weeks ago. Spent 3 days advocating for bighorn sheep programs and thin horn sheep programs. So
when you guys are doing that, like when you're down in D.C., are you meeting with? Do you tend to be meeting with individual politicians, or do you tend to be meeting like more on the agency level?
Both. So we meet with the federal agencies. So
all the land management agencies,
U.S. Forest Service. Most bighorn sheep live on U.S. Forest Service land. About in Clay, 80 some odd percent of bighorn sheep live on the forest. 70-80%. BLM, interesting enough, has huge holdings in Alaska. Alaska's got 25% of all Dall sheep and thin horn sheep in North America. So pretty huge population there. 40,000 to 50,000 Dall sheep. So we meet with the BLM, we meet with the Forest Service. At times we'll meet with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. At times we'll meet with the National Park Service. And then on the Hill, we'll meet with, representatives and senators and their staff. So, pretty broad base. The issues that we're dealing with are primarily land use issues, some grazing issues, and separation issues between domestic sheep and bighorn sheep, and now even thin horn sheep.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to get to and spend some time on, because I think that's kind of seems like where so much of the conversation is right now around sheep. But I want to do a little bit of backing up, and I'll let you guys can just kind of decide by making quick glances among each other to see who should handle what. But I want to like really quickly bring people up to speed on just like sheep taxonomy, which I think can be a little bit confusing. We don't need to go global. We'll just keep it North America. But is a fair is like when you say like bighorn, thin horn, is that a fair if you're going to take all of our country's sheep or U.S. and Canada and make some sort of division, it seems like people start with bighorn, thin horn.
You bet. So you have, you know, let's take North America as Mexico, U.S., and Canada.
Okay, perfect.
So in Mexico, you have the desert bighorn sheep. In the lower 48, you have the Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep and the desert bighorn sheep. Then we've got, you know, there's kind of splitters and lumpers. There's some divisions that come off of. There's the California bighorn sheep. That's really a Rocky Mountain. It didn't come from California. It came from British Columbia, of all places. There's a Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep. There's a Peninsula desert bighorn sheep. So there's a bunch of kind of subspecies. But the bottom line is there's desert bighorn sheep, Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, and then as we go north, you've got the stone sheep, which is primarily in northern British Columbia.
And that's a thin horn sheep.
That's a thin horn. And then the white sheep is the Dalles. So the stone sheep range in BC depends on the research you're looking at, but there's some new DNA studies that are pushing to the point that's really the only place they are. And that the stone sheep, and we still call them that, but the stone sheep that are in the Yukon Territory are actually Fannin sheep, or just a cross, if you will, and dark pelage of a cross between a white sheep, a Dall sheep, and the stone sheep. And the Dall sheep are in Alaska, Yukon, and Northwest Territory.
Or just the color phase of the Dalles.
Yeah, pelage.
Which really irritates people.
Oh,
because if you think you got your four North American wild sheep, right? Like, that's a big thing. You want to get your desert, your Rocky Mountain, your stones, and your Dalles. But, you know, they're starting to say, and Clay was explaining this to me earlier, you know, now they're going, well, maybe that Dalles is just, that or that stones, what you think is the stones is actually just a color phase of an actual Dalles. So it'd be like you going around and saying, man, yeah, I've shot a black bear and a grizzly bear, and then finding out actually your black bear was, or your what you think was your grizzly bear was just a brown phase black bear.
Yeah, I got you. But like when you get up, I'm confusing myself now. I want to stay below the U.S. Canada border for a minute. When you hear of the California's a Rocky, and then you hear in the old days that people had this idea there's the Audubon was a Rocky,
right? In the Missouri River breaks, we actually have an Audubon in our conference room. now extinct, although there's some debate on that with DNA, you know, the DNA studies that we can do now and the research, you know, the samples we can use. There's even some conflict of whether or not the Audubon was truly a separate subspecies.
That's what I was reading about recently.
Yeah, but yeah. The bottom line is we've repatriated bighorn sheep into the area that the Audubon was.
Gotcha.
The Missouri River Breaks, which is kind of the classic, beautiful, big Rocky Mountain sheep of Montana.
And then, so now jump up into Canada and going up into Alaska. Like at the time of European contact, would it just looked like one continuous string of sheep that just happened to get whiter the more farther north you went? Or were those populations like broken up?
No, they were broken up. And, you know, there is certainly a difference between a bighorn sheep and a thin horn sheep. So the thin horn sheep, and I don't know exactly what latitude they're above, but you know, those the stones and the dalles definitely look different than a Rocky Mountain bighorn. The Rocky Mountain bighorn are down in southern BC. You know, the front of the Rockies in Alberta, and then basically go down through the Dakotas, a little bit in Nebraska. Clay was just in Oklahoma. We now have bighorn sheep in Oklahoma. And then desert in Texas, and then as you go west and further south, you get into the deserts, but there's some states that have both. Nevada has the Nelson bighorn, Rocky Mountain bighorn, and California bighorn. But we really treat the California and the Rocky as the same.
If you look at the work and how it was done, you know, everybody named something in the 1800s, everybody threw a label on it, and then there was a guy named Cowan about 1940 or so that actually maybe the 60s, I can't remember exactly, but anyway, he did a lot of the original work, and they were measuring skulls and horns and looking at different ways. Well, in the 90s, Rob Ramey and John Wayhausen did some of that same work. And when it all came out, I tend to think simple as sheep are sheep. And they described stones and dalles to the north. So it's really two species, Rocky Mountain or bighorn sheep to the south and thin horns to the north. And then the subspecies, they described three, Rocky Mountains. They said Californias are the same. And there's lots of discussion. A lot of states don't agree, and a lot of folks go round and round over that. But then there was Sierra Nevada and deserts, and but they were measuring orbitals and taking various skull measurements. And this will be ironed out very soon. The genomics work that's occurring right now will answer every one of these questions. So just stand by. It's coming.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch the way the genetics work has changed. Because when I was working on my book, American Buffalo, and you read, you know, back 100 years and people had, there were seven different kinds, you know, and it was mostly just different people not orchestrating their activities, but we're seeing something somewhere and giving it a name and seeing something somewhere, giving it a name.
Yep.
And then always very eager to identify populations that weren't there anymore. And have it be that it was something entirely different.
Well, in Texas, they had Texana. They thought they had a different subspecies in Texas. It was most likely Mexicana, that subspecies. So it wasn't unique, but you'll still hear people talk about that.
Are there any places in Canada where a bighorn and a thinhorn sheep would run into each other?
You know, I've thought about that. In fact, we were kicking around that very thing earlier, and it's honestly no. But again, sheep are sheep. You know, they for what we know, the chances of them crossing paths probably slim to none. Just the habitat that they use and those sorts of things. But
they're geographically separated,
yeah, exactly,
by barriers that they're not likely to cross.
Exactly.
Yeah. You guys have some cool graphics in here that show what the population distribution now relative to when things were really dire and bad, relative to when things were like relatively unexploited. To what year do you have to go back before you hit like what would have been kind of like pre-contact baseline? meaning no extirpated, like no extirpated regional, no regional extirpations.
You know, that's a very tough question. There was a Seton in the 1929.
Ernest Thompson. Ernest Seton.
You know, it, what were the numbers? 1.5 to 2 million, something
yeah,
like
those
that.
Those guys paid fast and loose with numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. And, and there are folks today that will argue with those numbers, or a lot more effective at arguing those numbers than I am.
Or at least the confidence interval is really wide on
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, that's a tough thing. But, you know, if you try to read, you know, some of the accounts, Lewis and Clark's, and, you know, how much did they, you know, they talked about many, many animals. I don't know what that means. But if you, you know, all the way, you can trace some of that, it's particularly desert bighorns, you know, 1700s and things like that, when the conquistadors were traveling, you know, the missions, the priests describe what they observed. And it's pretty interesting, but the numbers are always tough. You know, if you look at in the 50s, what we do know is that numbers had probably declined to about 15,000, 17,000 animals, something like that. So they got pretty low.
So unless Seton was wildly off, there was still a big reduction.
There was far more than there were today.
You know, in terms of counting numbers, you guys familiar with how for a long time the fashionable number for bison was 60 million? And like you look into where that number came from. Well, Seton kind of like collated the whole thing, but it came from basically a big herd going by. It seemed to take days to go by. Later, Colonel Dodge of Dodge City Infamy has a conversation with another guy who saw the same thing. And hell, he must have been 3 miles away. And through this, right, comes this like wild estimation of how many there must be.
Yep.
So it is frustrating. I'm reading this book right now, Grizzlies in the Southwest. And the first part of the book is trying to collate all the cases where someone identified one. But you get into just terminology.
Yep.
And well, being like, is this, what is this guy talking about? Like, what is, you know, whoever's keeping records during the Coronado expedition, what is he talking about when he says X? Is that what he means?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll send you a story of the only grizzly bear killed in Texas.
I just read about that.
Did you?
Yeah.
In the Davis
Mountains, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just read that story.
It's in the Smithsonian, the skull is.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I could see that it'd be like exceedingly difficult to get a sense of what was where. But you could picture that. I mean, is it, like it's fair to say, like you take like Nevada, you take Montana, was like more of it was sheep country than not.
Oh yeah, if you look at the mountains in Nevada and look how it's laid out, and compare that to say Texas, you know, you can see just only the far west part of Texas. And if you look at where Scott works, you know, just some of the heritage the Native Americans have passed down, the stories and pictographs, we have a pretty good. Good idea where they occurred. Again,
that's interesting. Just representational art, huh?
Yeah,
like these people were drawing them, so they must be familiar with them.
Same story in Texas. I can show you pictographs of bighorn sheep in Texas. But numbers, it's an educated guess. Yeah. That's for sure.
I think it's a fair assumption to say that we had a lot of sheep. Yep. And their distribution was wide, the use of them culturally and for materials and food was widespread. The first explorers were encountering bighorn bows out way into Nebraska and out into the plains. The plains Indians were using bows made out of bighorn sheep horns.
Now, wasn't it most common though, like right out of the park?
Yes.
Because they used the hot water.
Yep, they were coming, basically being traded for, and you know, the pictograph record is very widespread. So I think it's a fair assumption to say we had a lot of sheep. They were widely distributed. There was a lot of cultures that were built around sheep. And obviously, I think you've probably read Journal of a Trapper, Osborne Ruffles. I mean, some of his descriptions, this is a guy that's seen Yellowstone Park area in its sort of in prime form and using descriptions of immense numbers of mountain sheep in the wintertime. So like, I think someone that uses the word immense numbers
he's
of
not
mountain
seen a
sheep.
Dozen.
No, this isn't a herd of 100 or 15 sheep on the side of a hill. The winter range was numerous. There was a lot of sheep there.
Have you read Francis Parkman's Oregon Trail?
I have not.
So he was a historian, and he wrote, like at the time, the definitive history of the French and Indian War, but he had health problems and was told to come out and spend time out in the West. And he comes out and travels on the Oregon Trail. And I think this is 1846. He actually winds up traveling with the Oglala Sioux. Probably was in the same camp with Crazy Horse when Crazy Horse was 13. They go up into the Black Hills to get lodgepole pine for tent lodgepoles. The guys he's traveling with get onto a big herd of bighorns and kill a bunch by throwing rocks down at them. So you get it, like, that's not two. That's like a size. There must be like sizable groups if that's your hunting strategies to hurl rocks down and successfully kill a bunch.
Yep, those kind of accounts, I think we're piecing all that information together, cultural accounts, early explorer accounts. We know what their range is, and modern day we know how many sheep of the habitat can support, so we can kind of piece it together, you know.
Like what the numbers might have been like. Right. So if you had to express like how bad it got, what's the best way to express how bad it got? Because you don't know the beginning number, so it's hard to do it numerically.
Yeah.
Like, how do you guys think about it when you think about restoration? Is it filling in the map, or is it achieving numbers?
Nah, it's a little bit of both. If you look and you're referencing this map that we've got in our conference room, and you know, let's say if we're using Seton's numbers of 1 to 2 million sheep, let's use a lower number of 1 million. Throughout North America, we reduced those in the 1960s down to 25,000. So
25,000 in what's now the U.S. or what,
U.S.
What's now
U.S. The U.S. All of North America, U.S., Canada, Mexico.
Bighorns, though.
Okay, so yeah. So not
the thin horns. The thin horn range is actually still distribution still pretty much the same.
Yeah, because they haven't come up against like the obstacles, right?
No, they haven't, and that's what you're trying to prevent. But the bighorns did. So you're looking at if it's 500 or 1 million or 1.5 or $2 million, we or 2 million sheep, we reduced those numbers down to 25,000 by the late 1960s. Today we're at about 85,000 bighorn sheep in Canada, U.S. and Mexico.
So it's been a good restoration.
25,000 in all of North America.
I want to talk about why it got that way. But at the low point with sheep, were you then finding that you had states? I know we talked about Texas. Were there multiple states that had completely run out?
You bet. You bet. If you look at some of the data that we'll show, we'll reference remnant population. Some were just gone. Texas, gone. Nevada was down to a remnant population. They're an absolute incredible success story. They had 100 or 200. What does remnant mean? 200 sheep. They're up to 11,000 desert bighorns right now. They probably got about 12,000 to 13,000 bighorn sheep in Nevada today.
And they were down to what's called a remnant.
Remnant
which is sub 100
in the 1970s. Yeah,
which would be sub 100.
You bet. So it's pretty amazing.
What states were like the big holdouts?
Wyoming strong.
Really? Wyoming stayed strong.
Wyoming did pretty well. I think Montana did pretty well.
Hanging out.
Colorado pretty well, but still.
Who was housing? What states provided the last refugia for the deserts? Desert bighorns. Like what states would had like wound up when all the smoke cleared?
Clay, Arizona.
Arizona.
New Mexico. New Mexico was down. So
they were way down.
Pretty much Mexico and Arizona.
California. I don't remember how low the numbers got in California. Nevada's got, most of them are remnant. It was rough.
And Mexico held on to some.
Mexico did.
In the Sierra Madre? Where?
Most of it was just, well, in the Baja.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah.
Yeah, Baja, Sonora.
I'm part of the country, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because Baja, man, like as far as like representational art.
Yes. Baja North.
I've been spent time down there. Man, there's tons of pictographs. Pictographs of bighorns and mule deer,
And they've held their own even today. They do pretty well. There are a lot of sheep. In Sonora alone, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but there are probably in Sonora, Mexico alone, probably 7,500 sheep just in that state. And then
Sonora?
Yeah.
Yeah, we hunt down there. I never run into one. Must be in the wrong part of the... what was the... I kind of already know this answer because I know it was like disease and pot hunting. But like what made it so bad? Like, how did it get so bad?
Well, there were lots of things, that a combination of things. Civilization. Railroads were moving
in a blanket term, yeah. and all the wonders that it brings.
Yeah, and Scott can speak to the stuff a little bit further north. But as far as the stuff in the south, you know, if you read Texas history, the railroad came through, and you'd read accounts where, you know, they were feeding railroad workers. And a guy would hunt meat for the railroads, and he would hit where our prime habitat is, and he would say, I had them in a box canyon, and I got every one of them. And so he would take the meat back, feed railroad workers. But it was disease issues and competition for forage and limited water and forage with domestic livestock that had come in later. And people were trying to feed their families. It was tough places to make a living.
So if you break out, like let's say you break out market hunting, and who was that famous photographer that used to work out of Miles City? Huffman, L.A. Huffman. He was taking pictures in the early 1880s of market hunter camps where they had just all kinds of bighorns lined up that they're killing along the Yellowstone. But if you were going to take out, if you're going to divide it, like let's say you had habitat issues, okay, so grazing competition, water, whatever, market hunting and disease, are they tiered out, or are they all just equal players?
Oh no, it's if you're trying to piece the story together that Scott described, you typically look at land use history and you look at how things occurred or what might have occurred. And today the greatest obstacle that we face is disease. And so chances are that was the greatest threat, the thing that caused the most problems in the 1800s, along with those other things, but in my view, it would be diseases and competition for forage and limited water in the desert environment anyway.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Just to give you a perspective, like if you think about it in terms of grazing and just use a Northeast Oregon example, and that corner of Oregon, Wallowa County, where Hell's Canyon is located, there was about the turn of the century, there was 300,000 sheep grazing in that county.
No.
Yes. Yep. So there was an immense number of sheep, domestic sheep.
Yeah, yeah.
In, sorry, 300 domestics grazing in Wallowa County. So that was
the county alone had 300,000 domestic
yep.
sheep.
Yep. So we're, you know, obviously it was great grazing land for domestic sheep, and so people were grazing. There was no Taylor Grazing Act. It was sort of a free-for-all on the public land system, which is, you know, probably not fully established at that time. And you know, we had a lot of domestics right in the bighorn habitat.
So we should probably talk about the disease, like disease. When we say disease carried them off, is it a host of diseases that hits bighorns, or is it a disease that hits bighorns?
It is a disease complex. So there's, Clay can fill in the gaps, but there's, based on our last decade of research, I mean, it's been an evolving story over time where people are we're constantly learning new information all the time as our techniques in science get better and our experimentation gets better and our insights get better. But what all the research points to now is it's one particular bacteria that our North American sheep did not evolve with. So they're hosted by the domestic species. When they come in contact with each other, the bighorn sheep contract that bacteria. They're no longer able to fight off other infections. So it compromises their cilia and their trachea. So they aren't able to move other bacteria out, and they succumb to basically pneumonia, but from other it's a back, you know, polymicrobial disease is the term. So they're very naive to this disease. The MO, it's called Mycoplasma ovi pneumoniae. So we call it MOV for short. And just because it's a mouthful.
What's the term for short?
MOV.
MOV.
M period OV.
Okay.
And it's.
And this is a disease that seems to have originated in
old world sheep in Europe.
And
yep.
They perhaps were exposed to it for 10,000 years.
They had evolved with it. Yeah. Correct. So they carry it. They're not clinically affected by it. We don't see the same symptoms that we do in bighorns where they're coughing or having nasal sinus discharge. So it doesn't appear to have a strong population level effect, or has no population level effect on domestic sheep. So some lambs will succumb to it, you know, once they're kind of getting close to weaning. But our bighorn sheep lambs will be infected early on, and it's very fatal. And these strains, there's many strains. They have different severity and the reactions within bighorn population. So it's a complicated disease issue, and that's why it's taken us so long to sort this all out.
So was this disease hitting bighorns before anybody knew that this disease was hitting bighorns?
For sure, yeah.
It was like, I don't know what happened to them all.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about the habitat that these animals live in, how frequently do we, how well studied are herds now with our level of technology and our dedication, but back in the 1800s, I don't know how many people were looking at them.
Yeah, Steve, a great analogy would be looking at what we did to Native American tribes with smallpox. It's, you know, so similar. And when we talk about Mycoplasma ovum pneumonia as a setup agent, in lay terms, even though they're not the same, you know, it's kind of HIV in sheep. HIV is an immune deficiency. This is not. This is a bacterium. It's a pathogen, but it's a setup agent. So, Joe is 32 years old, and you heard he died of pneumonia, and you go, my God, you know, Joe's 32 years old. How's a 32-year-old guy die of pneumonia? Oh, well, you know, he had AIDS, HIV, and compromised his immune system, and he got pneumonia and died.
Okay.
Very similar to what's happening with sheep. As Scott had pointed out, that the Mycoplasma pneumonia, or MOVI, lays down the cilia in the esophagus. And allows other bugs, other pathogens, other bacteria to get down into the lungs. They can't cough it out. The cilia is not moving it out. They get sick, and then what we used to just say is, well, they died of pneumonia. Well, actually, they probably died of something else, but MOVI, as we're able to study it more and more and more, MOVI was present. There's a litany of other pathogens, Mannheimia hemolytica. There's new research that is looking at nasal tumors. These sheep, which a mountain sheep, when you look at where they live in some of the harshest climates in North America, some of the most unique climates in North America, the sad thing is from a respiratory standpoint, they're pretty darn weak. Our vice president of conservation, Kevin Hurley, says it, I think, pretty succinctly. He says the damn things are born looking for a place to die. It's challenging. It is a disease complex, and every time we Wild Sheep Foundation has spent millions and millions of dollars into disease research. We endow a chair of wild sheep disease at Washington State University. Every rock we overturn that we think we've got the solution, this is it. This is now. There's four other rocks underneath it that we unturn or overturn those, and there's four more other questions that we don't know the answer to.
So I want to explore the timeline a little bit on the numbers collapsing, but no one really knew where we started. No one had done like this exhaustive analysis of where sheep exist and how many there were. But it's just like anyone who's paying attention can't miss the fact that they're vanishing. At what point do people, like this organization or other individuals or state agencies, at what point do people go like, wow, we need to like get on top of this and start taking some step? And at that time, were they then aware of what was causing the problem? Or were people doing restoration and then all the sheep die again? Without even knowing that the real issue was disease, thinking it might have been something else. Does that question make sense?
It absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And Clay and Scott can dream in, but you know, we were probably putting sick sheep into clean sheep. So we were making some errors back
just
then.
Because
we just didn't know. We didn't know that source herd had Mycoplasma ovum pneumonia. And so we plopped in, no doubt, in transplants, we plopped in sick sheep on top of clean sheep.
So that became the primary restoration tool was transplanting sheep.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The early years was protection. Every state, 1905, 1910, 1903, every state implemented something. The first translocation occurred in 1922. Since then, there have been probably close to 1,500 separate operations, removing somewhere in the neighborhood of 22,000 animals that have been moved. One place to another.
So in 1903 in Texas, they're like, it's bad enough you can't kill one.
And it wasn't just sheep. Keep that in mind. It was mule deer and pronghorn and all wildlife in those days. I mean, everything was suffering.
Yeah.
But it was. There's no doubt about it. The tool, translocations, was the tool. You know, we worked with Nevada Department of Wildlife, and we would trap sheep on the landscape. I would be on the side of a mountain. We would trap sheep. We had a trailer, double-decker trailer, fill that trailer full as many as many sheep as they would give us. And then as fast as we could get back to Texas, give them a handful of turkeys. give them whatever it was they wanted, because we were beggars. That was the bottom line. We were beggars at that time. So anyway, go back to Texas, and 24 hours later, dumping them on the landscape. Well, we were drawing blood samples, but we would never wait for the results of those samples. So if something would have happened, the cat would have been out of the bag by then.
Yeah.
So now we sample source and recipient populations in advance, and we look at those kind of things. So we're a lot smarter in the way we do business.
That's a horrible thought to think of, just out of a very excusable form of ignorance, to spend that time and energy.
Oh, there's no doubt we did it to ourselves.
And go and infect a clean herd.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Because if you look at the disease itself, it can only come from a live animal, and there's no doubt about it. Now that can be domestic sheep, domestic goats, but it can also be bighorn sheep, and it can also be wild goats.
So that bacteria doesn't do well laying on the dirt.
No, it does not. It does. It has to. It comes from a live source. So, but we've again.
How close? Like, let's talk about let's talk about the transmission for a minute.
I don't know. I'm gonna let
it's
Scott.
A little bit of a rabbit hole, but we can.
Because it's not well understood. I'm just talking about, like, okay, you got a sick. Let's not even bring in domestic sheep.
They don't have to touch noses. Let's just put it.
Exactly.
Let's not even bring domestic sheep, but two bighorns.
If the pens are too close together, WSU has a captive herd, and they got them. I think one of the early trials, they got a little too close to their clean sheep from the sick sheep.
We're talking inches or feet or yards?
Feet. Yards.
You're talking about, in some cases, maybe kilometers.
Distance. If that's the case, then what do you mean then? Like, what do you mean it has to go from sheep to sheep? Because it's just airborne?
Aerosol, yeah.
Let's go back to the... If you look at the issues associated with this disease, I mean, when it comes down to it, all wildlife, they adapt to the various pathogens that they're introduced to in some form or fashion. And so how it affects bighorn sheep is you either have a complete die-off. I mean, they just do terrible. Or you see it where, a mother will pass down antibodies to lambs. And at first, when you see them, the first few weeks of life, they seem to do pretty well. But about 8 weeks, 8 to 12 weeks, something like that, then you start seeing issues, and then you have complete lamb die-off. So in other words, you have complete die-offs, then you have no recruitment for decades. And then the other part of that is that you have some sheep that, for whatever reason, they don't die, and they go from herd to herd, from this one to that one. Typhoid Mary.
So they become a carrier who's not affected.
That is a carrier that sheds that disease to other populations. So bighorn sheep move.
Yep. They move, and the other thing is they are long-lived species generally in the absence of disease. Ewes can live close to 20 years, and rams are, kind of the 10 to 12 is a long-lived ram. So some of these particular carriers can be alive for a long time, moving around and keeping that disease in the herd, and it's not able to fade out.
How much do you guys see, how much have you seen bighorns move?
A long ways.
Not like, yeah, don't give me the, no, I'm always interested in the crazy number, but give me the normal number.
The normal number.
And then, then hit me with a crazy number.
Okay, so the number that we're using based on sort of this estimation from telemetry data that was sort of a published model that we use for sort of risk of contact modeling. So how likely are bighorn sheep going to go out in the landscape and contact a particular distance from their home range, right? So all animals set up a home range. Generally, bighorn sheep do exploratory movements where they leave their home range and then may return. So whether it's to see what's going on the next ridge or to look for receptive ewes, but generally the number there is 35 kilometers. So basically 95% of ram movements over a 14-year data set showed that almost, you know, 95% of those movements were within 35 kilometers from their home range.
How big is his core zone?
That varies. It could be large, or it could be tight. You know,
just depends on the habitat
and the particular individual. So some individuals may have small home ranges, some might have larger. So the crazy number is a little a ram that came out of the Lostine herd just this past couple of years.
And where is that?
Near Joseph, Oregon. Okay. Enterprise and Joseph, up in the Wallowa Range.
Yeah, I know that area.
So he took a little walk and he went on a loop. So they collared him. He showed up, I think, on somebody's deck and was just taking, and they took a good photo and they recognized, sent him to the Hell's Canyon Initiative folks, and they recognized him as 12LO27. Hey, we ear tagged him as a lamb. So they knew they had a definitive age on him, and he went across the Snake River, the Salmon River, and then over into the Clearwater drainage in Idaho. And they put a collar on him at some point. They actually put three collars on him because they kept failing him. So he got caught two or three times with a helicopter, and I think he got darted once. So, and he made a 378-mile loop through seven different home ranges of bighorns, and he was out in some wheat fields and crossed a bunch of highways. And so he went 125 miles from his home range and covered in that year and a half time or so with the collar, he covered 378 miles and then died on a remote point in Hell's Canyon.
Natural causes.
Presumably, yeah, that was during. I think it was during the winter, so they couldn't get in there with any other waves. Had the jet boat, so I don't remember how long it was when the collar went on mortality until they went and recovered it.
So he just went on a cruise.
He was just like, yeah. So I mean, it kind of just demonstrates the behavior potential of these animals, that some of them are going to move, and they show up in town. You know, when you have a civilization at the bottom of a nice canyon that joins up to another big canyon, they're going to come through, and it happens pretty regularly. Especially in that landscape of Hell's Canyon, Lower Hell's Canyon.
Yeah, so this brings up a big question. So how, we haven't really set up like what needs to happen here, if we know what needs to happen. But if they're going to go do that, how do you ever protect them from picking up transmittable diseases and spreading them to everybody else?
Right. That's the million-dollar question.
Well, and Steve, the protocol of many Western states is when a bighorn sheep comes in contact with domestic sheep, that bighorn sheep is shot. So that's a standing, acting protocol, because the fear is that that bighorn could then be the, you know, the vector, and as you know, this damn ram did. I mean, goes on a walkabout and could have gone through a whole bunch of herds. So, you know, kind of now, so the standard protocol
would be the
administrative removal. Yeah.
You would kill, like, a state agency would kill that ram.
And they're trying to get away from that where possible. So that just the setup I was talking about, where some animals will show up in, say, a town along the Snake River where there's bighorn habitat on all sides, and they show up in town, and, you know, generally the old method was, let's remove this animal so it can't go back. And
they're removing it for the express purpose.
To protect the rest of the sheep.
It could have picked up pneumonia.
It could have made contact, especially if it was seen. Obviously, the ones that are documented in a pasture with domestic sheep or domestic goats, you know, most of the time. But what they're trying to do now is, based on their proximity to WSU, is that we try to put, you know, dart the animal, live capture it, then hold and test, or else take it to the WSU facility. And so it becomes a research animal, basically.
I'd like to, this was like my big aha moment when I came here, right? I was sitting with our biologist across the hall, and he just kind of said it like it was just something that Oh, it just happens. And I'm like, so you're telling me I could go get a grazing permit for my domestic sheep, go into public land, and then that wild sheep comes down and boom, they shoot it.
Is that, can that go on?
Yeah, and it does. You know, so we see in the breaks a couple of years ago, there was two young rams. They went within 3/4 of a mile of a domestic sheep herd, and boom, they were shot.
By state?
Yep, yep, because of them being a vector.
Yep. So what's your, do you guys have an official stance on the practice? Like, is there an alternative to that? I mean, just to that part of it right there.
No, we you know, our objective is to keep the two species separate.
Okay.
So if there's known contact, you know, if you can send them off to WSU or send them off to Sabeel in Wyoming, great. But, you know, you think about that, that's also a death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to now be a guinea pig for disease testing. So the, you know, that there's really not much we can do other than keep the two separated. So, you know, we circle back to Washington, D.C. You know, that's what we're advocating for back in Washington, D.C. is federal land managers and agencies to work for spatial and temporal separation of wild sheep and domestic sheep.
What's that need to look like? I can imagine where it becomes contentious.
Oh, you bet.
Could you mind like sketching out the obvious and how does that become a contentious conversation?
Well, you know, you got, I was just back there with a producer who's a domestic sheep producer. He's the largest public land domestic sheep producer in Montana. He's a good guy, and he gets it, and he does his best to keep his domestic sheep away from wild sheep. And he wants more wild sheep on Montana's mountains, but you know the issue is litigation. Wild Sheep Foundation is really not a litigant type organization. We feel we'd rather sit around a table and work out solutions. So you know our objective there, Steve, would be to sit down with that producer and go, all right, you know the Western way of doing things is having a whiskey, chatting, acknowledging that there's an issue first and foremost, and then looking for solutions. Is it times of year when a producer's trailing through an area? Is it how he uses or she uses the you know upper allotments or you know these high mountain allotments? So we've done various programs in various states. There's a few states that have very good collaboratives where you have a wild sheep and domestic sheep interaction working group. We don't always agree, but we sit around a table once or twice a year and say, let's come up with solutions that we can work this out. Doesn't work everywhere. You know, Wild Sheep Foundation's official position is we want healthy and, expanding wild sheep herds. But we also support a vibrant domestic sheep industry. The key is there's often places that are just absolutely incompatible in the same landscape. We have worked with permittees to convert. If it's a high conflict area, you've got a large population of bighorn sheep, large population of domestic sheep, and we know there's going to be contact. We've worked with some producers to convert them to cattle where appropriate. There have been situations where we've worked with producers to pay them, almost like a CRP program in the Midwest, but pay them to retire their allotment or vacate their allotment.
Just to look at like what would you make in profits running sheep, and can we take conservation dollars?
And we'll pay you to not do it. Yeah, we take private conservation dollars to pay you to not do it. We just
so in those cases, you have a willing seller, willing buyer scenario.
Absolutely, and we paid a just because we're these deals are typically confidential, so I won't even mention the state. But we paid a producer $427,000 to vacate their allotment. They were also getting into trouble with grizzly bears and wolves. Constant problem. So the expansion of grizzly bears and expansion of wolves has in some ways benefited bighorn sheep in some states because the permittees want to get the hell out of there, and they come to NGOs like Wild Sheep Foundation and say, can you give us a hand?
Yeah.
And we do. And we do, and we've spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars doing that. And you nailed it on a willing seller, willing buyer deal.
But what does it look like? You're talking about big, organized producers, okay, who presumably have kind of like a business sensibility. They have a sense of profit loss. But what about all the people that just have two or three sheep?
Excellent question.
How do you even know who they are?
Excellent question.
Because, I mean, I could go, like, my brother, he doesn't live in, you know, he lives in formerly Bighorn Country. He's got some sheep. He's got 10 acres of irrigated pasture. He's got sheep out there. There's nothing to prevent him from having a buddy come over and say, hey, man, I'd love to have a lamb for my place. Nothing, there's no paperwork.
Yeah. So the key there is,
how do you even know?
The key there is education. You know, so I mean, on this podcast, I mean, we're going to be educating people that there's an issue. I came from Texas, and I go down to Houston, and I give a presentation. And I talk about the disease issue and to a hunting community that you would presume would know something about it, and it's kind of blank stares and never heard of it. Truth be told, I came to Wild Sheep Foundation for Dallas Safari Club. I wasn't aware of it. I've been in the hunting and conservation industry for 18 years. I hadn't heard about it. So it's education. Wild Sheep Foundation obviously respects private landowners, respects private land rights, and your ability to do what you want on your land. But, our effort there would be to educate those private landowners or those recreational producers or hobby flocks or whatever you want, 4-H. FFA, a lot of 4-H animals out there that could get in trouble. Educate them. I just spent two days on the Missouri River with a private producer in southern BC who gets it. And interesting enough, he's got a small flock of domestic sheep. They're actually mouflon sheep. And he's in proximity to bighorn habitat. And he's a part of an interaction working group in southern BC. And he was the guy that asked the question of them. He goes, well, why don't I, as a producer, test my sheep for MOVI? He did. And he's got an MOVI-free flock. And he's now one of our biggest advocates as a domestic sheep producer for MOVI-free flocks, so that would be potentially one of the solutions in the small areas.
That's pretty interesting to think about because, I mean, you know, a lot of states have managed to get brucellosis out of livestock herds.
You bet.
Is that an area of interest to think that you could expand?
Absolutely.
Pneumonia-free sheep?
Well, they would, you know, they'd be MOVI-free sheep. There's a Dr. Tom Besser, who's our Rocky Crate Endowed Chair. He's at Washington State University, probably one of the world's foremost experts on this issue. And he's advised us that if you have an MOVI-free domestic flock, that's about a 97% solution to this issue. So that is exciting. But there's a fly in the ointment.
You don't say.
Scott just talked about that ram that did a 300-some-odd-mile walkabout.
Yeah, if he's infected.
Well, so we've got, you know, we know that MOVI is not endemic to bighorn sheep, but MOVI is now resident in bighorn sheep. So we have herds in, you know, we're in Montana, so we have herds in Montana that they test positive for MOVI. As Scott pointed out, there's a variety of strains. It's kind of like the, you know, not necessarily, but again, layman's terms, kind of like the flu or the cold. You know, sometimes you get one hell of a common cold. Sometimes you get a little light one. Sometimes you get a flu, you know, there's a flu virus that, you know, that just wipes you out. Other times it's not so bad. Same thing with, you know, strains of MOVI. This bighorn may be able to live with it. Well, now here's the fly in the ointment. What if we have a private land domestic sheep producer doing the right thing?
Spending tons of money to do it.
Tons of money testing his or her sheep. They're MOVI free. They make sure they only bring in stock from MOVI free. And we get a wandering bighorn that's MOVI positive. Yeah. Now we've switched the dynamic there. And, you know, the fact is we've got to be intellectually honest and go, we're still back into a separation scenario. Now we're trying to separate, you know, these MOVI-free, clean domestic sheep from a potentially infected wild sheep.
The truth of the matter, if we're going to have to think different. We can't continue to do the way we've done in the past. And I think there are opportunities that we miss. And I want to emphasize the work that was done. Gray mentioned private landowners earlier. We restored bighorn sheep in Texas with private landowners.
Because you didn't have a choice there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we figured out a way to do this together. And these are people who care. And our goal is certainly not to put people out of business. To me, the way we do this is we figure out new solutions, better way of doing business. We sit down at the same table. We don't play the politics. We stop denying that the disease exists. It's real. You asked me a question or asked us all a question earlier. Didn't you have any ideas? You watched those numbers decline. Everybody thought they had a pretty good idea why. It just never was demonstrated or proven. And later on, that information came in a controlled experiment, and where we knew that it did occur. And then the question became, well, that didn't really occur in the wild. You guys did that in a controlled setting. It really doesn't occur in the wild. It does. So the first thing we have to do is acknowledge that we've got a problem. And then we start working together. And Grace says it best. He talks about, you know, it's okay to have both on the landscape. They just can't be there at the same time at the same place. And so we have to figure out what that does look like. But we are going to have to think outside the box. How do we do things? I know and probably will suck the air out of this room, but we allow private landowners in Texas to benefit from sheep tags. There's an incentive there for landowners to work with us, and it's worked extremely well. Landowners are willing to do whatever it takes. Landowners allow public hunters on their property to hunt. We hunt each other's property. We do research. We capture sheep on private land. So there are lots of other examples. That's
like,
just one.
Like in that model, you're going for a thing where you're trying to change the landowner perception of what it means to have sheep.
Well, exactly.
That it's not just like you're screwed now, buddy. There's a sheep on your property.
Exactly. Yeah. And you'll never, as a private landowner or a producer, why would I care if there were sheep, bighorn sheep around here if I saw no benefit from that?
Yeah.
And so I think there are opportunities that we haven't explored that we need to. We need to sit down at the same table, work through some of these issues. But we can't do that if we don't acknowledge that the disease exists, and if every time something major happens or an obstacle comes up, a stumbling block, we run straight to D.C.
Are there pneumonia deniers?
Oh, absolutely.
Really? That seems to be a common theme across a handful of wildlife diseases.
Right, the CWD deniers have come on. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, there's deniers, and then there's users of, you know, we've seen it used as a leveraging tool. When they know that we'll pay to play,
gotcha.
You know, they'll say, hey, you know, hey, we're going to bring in some domestics in here.
What do y'all think of that?
Right. Or, you know, there's a guy in Gardner somewhere. He got pissed. He lost his grazing allotments and said, all right, and brought in domestic sheep. Well, we lost 43 sheep that winter. Just because he was like, well, I'll show you.
We had a guy down in Wyoming that he was basically a cattle producer, but he had cattle allotments up to 11,000 feet in the mountains in the in prime bighorn habitat, and he was you know not the best grazer in the world, and he'd gotten in trouble with the BLM constantly, and he lost his BLM cattle allotments. He goes, fine, I'm going to put domestic sheep on my deeded land up at 11,000 feet right in bighorn habitat. Now what are you going to do? So, you know,
he's just doing like, it's just retribution.
That's wildlife terrorism. Wildlife terrorism because, he knows, so as Garrett said, you know, you've got people, you got deniers, and then you got those that'll use it as a weapon.
Well, and that also occurs on just the different public lands issues. There are some who would use the grazing part of it as or the anti-grazing part of it, bring bighorns into that just to lay that on the table. In other words, it's all about where it might be about public land grazing. That's not what we're about either. It has nothing to do with that.
I don't follow what you're saying.
Well, one of the public land guys can say it better. There are some groups who would use bighorn sheep to say that gotcha. We don't want any grazing on public land, so let's use bighorn sheep to accomplish that.
So someone who had an agenda where they felt like they weren't so much pro bighorn as they were anti-grazing on public lands,
exactly.
And they'd be like, this would be a great place for some bighorns.
Exactly.
Because I know that I'll be able to manipulate right. that into achieving my other goal.
And that's not our mission. Our mission is simple. We put and keep sheep on the mountain. And if we're going to do this, we're going to have to do it together with livestock producers. And I think there's some really good examples out there of people working together.
Well, I think that the key, like, you know, I've met with and have spoken with a lot of very effective players in the conservation space, people like the people in this room in this organization who have a long track record. And the thing that I find that these groups are in is you're in the middle and you got some crazies off to each side and you're trying to guide, right? You're trying to keep this thing moving along with some pretty radical fringe elements probably barking at you from both sides.
Absolutely.
You know, and then I think, you know, going back to, he just keeps preaching education and it's huge, huge. You know, I've worked with, spoke with your buddy Ryan Callahan a lot. Like mm-hmm. you talk to these companies who one of their biggest things is wool, you know, and they're always preaching that they're selling great wool products. Well, where do you get it?
Yeah.
You know, you have some people that are,
they get from New Zealand, I think.
They do. And yeah. so they're safe, right? Same with Sitka. They're safe, you know, so talking with Sitka and First Light, I mean, like, hey guys, you guys want to talk about where you get your wool from or maybe where you shouldn't. You have some groups that say we're environmentally friendly, you know, because we source our wool here locally and there's not these shipping things and all that. And then you go, well, where do you get it? And they go, oh, Colorado. And you go, oh. So you're just killing, you know, I sat next to Yvon Chouinard up on stage talking about how, yeah, if you're sourcing your wool west of the Mississippi, you're probably contributing to the die-off of bighorn sheep. And that got an interesting, I mean,
yeah, that's a bold statement, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and
or
it's
like, not, I should say a bold statement, but a statement that people could read into pretty heavily.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I probably should have followed it up more, but people just don't understand. And a lot of times these people building the garments don't understand. Talking with, you know, Ryan Callahan is a very educated dude when it comes to conservation, and a lot of these things he had no idea about. So
if we talk about, if we look at this, like the separation thing, the separation idea, well, first I want to address something you just brought up. Is there the equivalent of like labeling something organic or labeling an organization to be of a certain pedigree of 401k nonprofit? Like, is there, do you guys have a way where you like are certifying or giving a stamp of approval to certain producers for practicing?
No.
We looked into it.
Yeah.
You did,
yeah.
We had a you know, kind of a wild sheep safe campaign. And it's the challenge with that, Steve, is it did get into a certification process. And we didn't have the staff. And you know, then we talked to our attorneys and they went, oh, man, you certify one and not a, you know. So,
yeah.
We kind of backed away from that on the wild sheep safe, and it's almost like Scott had said on, you know, what is effective separation? What is the distance?
That's, yeah, know? I do so want to talk about that separation.
You know, yeah, it's a real challenge there.
And but so, like in Puget Sound, there's like a type of building that's like, oh, what they call it, salmon safe or salmon country or something, and a building can comply in a certain way, and it has to do with the quality of their runoff.
Well,
right,
so,
that has to do with that you've achieved some threshold, some
bet.
Measurable threshold of acknowledgement that this water is going to be used by salmon.
And this is what Garrett touched on, and so we're kind of looking at a concept of conflict-free lamb and wool, And we're still fleshing that out. I mean, there's responsible wool standards that the wool industry uses. Interesting enough, I've read through most of the organizations that have responsible wool standards. It's more animal husbandry. It's, you know, it's transportation. It's predator control, whether or not there's some predator control going on in your area. They may think that's non-friendly.
But they're not concerned about wildlife.
Nothing in there talks about bighorn sheep.
It's more like animal rights issues than wildlife issues.
You bet. So we're we're reaching out to some of those more environmental groups to say, hey, if you're gonna run down this path, you better put bighorns in the picture. But as we mature, you know, this conflict free space, it too is more of an education program. I mean, we will probably never be able to have completely conflict-free scenarios in the Western United States, unless you put the wool industry and the lamb industry out of business, and that's not our objective. I mean, that's just not our objective.
Let me ask this. Does the wool and lamb industry in the West absolutely rely on public land grazing?
No.
Okay.
No. There's about 60 to 70 families.
And that's the,
but bighorns probably rely on private land.
No, more bighorns are on public land.
Even in the wintertime?
Yeah, still. It's 70 to 80% of the time they're spending on public land. Okay. So there is a public land grazing scenario, and it just varies on states. Montana, it's not really the issue. Public land grazing is not the issue. It's more education of private recreational herds, or producers. Colorado is probably the ground zero for the public land grazing issue. With a lot of conflict zones. The BLM and the Forest Service have risk of contact maps. You can look at a map and it'll show active domestic sheep grazing allotments, occupied bighorn range, and active BLM allotments, and then red conflict zones. So they're mapped out. I mean, there's risk of contact analysis that's going on. The bottom line is we pretty much know where the touch points and the hot points are. One of the solutions that we're looking at is what if we took the top 10 hot points and pick a state, Colorado. What if we took the top 10 hot points that, man, we've got, real critical core bighorn herds in that area, and we've got some pretty significant conflict zones. What if we address those first? You know, it's eating the elephant one bite at a time. I mean, it's a huge issue. It's a huge problem. The disease issue is complex. We don't have all the answers. But what if we could, incrementally, 10% at a time start addressing those issues with a variety of tools. Some of them are going to be bottom line moving a producer out of that area. But the key there is, can we find that producer other grass to graze? Are there private land areas? Are there tools that we haven't used yet? Can the wild sheep advocacy community, if we're not going to buy you out, can we incentivize you to go on to some lower elevation pivot point, some alfalfa field or some other grass field that you can utilize instead of high mountain summertime allotments where bighorn sheep are grazing?
Yeah, I got
so, you. we got to get clever. And Clay said it, and we've got a program that we call our new narrative, but the premise is we've been doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different result. It's time to change that. We all know that's called insanity if you expect a different result. So we want to sit down with willing producers who are progressive and get it and don't deny that there's an issue, and sit down and say, hey, you want to keep your family in business, and it's a part of the Western landscape. We respect that. As a multiple use advocacy organization, which is what Wild Sheep Foundation is, we respect that. But let's not do the same thing over and over and expect a different result. Let's do different things and get different results.
And something Gray says a lot too, that there's those that sue and those that do, and we're kind of like that first group that knocks on the door, and when we get denied, then we go, all right, well, when they knock on the door, it's probably not going to be as pretty.
Yeah.
You know, so we're kind of like that, just right at the beginning saying, hey, let's work things out. And then when we leave, if we get denied, you know, and there's unfortunate reality that other groups just come in and they're going to sue them.
Yeah. You had a comment?
It kind of got a little bit lost in there, but I'll just chime in with the tribe's perspective on some of this, and it's really tied to public land grazing. And so the tribes I work for have a treaty reserve right to harvest bighorn sheep. And that's
a deal with the federal government.
It's the trust responsibility of the federal government, and they are, at this time, permitting through a federal action grazing of domestic sheep that knowingly adds risk to our populations of sheep, bighorns. So we just basically can't accept that because we really can't quantify the risk. So we can quantify a minimum risk.
I want you to say it a little more clearly. You're saying the tribe has a deal with the federal government that they can hunt bighorns.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's reserved in their Treaty of 1855,
and
too.
They're able to argue that the federal government, by giving the grazing allotments to domestic sheep, is hindering their treaty right.
If we are knowingly adding risk to population viability, and I think we can demonstrate that with the science.
It's like coming through a back door to
grazing domestic sheep on, you know, suitable and prime bighorn habitat is very problematic for us. And that's just the nature of it. And I mean, yes, we are, you know, not against public land grazing, but we just need to take a hard look at where is suitable to graze domestic sheep and where is not. And we need to protect the sheep we have, but we have to look at how are we going to expand our sheep populations. If we have allotments that are stocked with domestic sheep in historic and prime bighorn habitat that would be suitable otherwise, we got to think about that.
So when you're working for the tribe, mm-hmm. as a biologist, do you wind up interfacing with these guys at Wild Sheep Foundation? Mm-hmm. Are you in communication?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the conversations that you guys have?
Private. No, it's always a great discussion because this is a tough question. You know,
I mean, you guys are coming at it from the same side of the thing, or you want what's best for bighorns.
We do. The tribe has a very different worldview of that, right?
Yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah, that was something that was taken away, and it's still a cultural memory. It's there. They want to be fully exercise that, and a couple of tags is not sufficient. We do coordinate with the states for on issuing bighorn sheep tags. And so that's a little bit of a sore point. So we really need to figure out how we can move the needle and get sheep back where they belong.
Yeah, so how does that work? When they're on Indian reservation land, then they're technically owned by...
Well, we don't have bighorn sheep on the reservation. We have a relatively small reservation.
But you have hunting rights offside the reservation.
We do. Yeah. On about four different herds of sheep. And so we work with the states and figure out a tag allocation allotment, and we hold a drawing just kind of similar to the state drawing.
And they'd like to see more bighorn tags.
Oh, yeah.
Which means they need to see more bighorns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Are you guys, I know you can't really answer this, but I'm just going to throw it out there anyway. Optimistic or pessimistic about bighorns? I mean, a lot of like good work's been done, right, man? I mean, we were down to 25,000. We're up to what?
85,000.
What's a livable number for you?
You know, that is the tough one. Is where do we want to go? And I guess the best way for us to express that is we would like to see bighorn sheep everywhere they are now suitable. The problem is, okay, Steve. You know, suitable. What does that mean? Where they're safe. It's tough to find places to translocate bighorn sheep that they're not going to get into trouble.
The trouble being just this trouble, disease.
Trouble running into a domestic herd.
Like is that the obstacle?
Number one inhibiting factor on restoration of bighorn sheep is contact with domestic sheep and goats.
So is it fair to say, like, if it wasn't for the disease, not blame whoever, but if the disease, for whatever reason, didn't exist, is it fair to say that we might have a million bighorns or 500,000 bighorns in the country?
Well, we certainly have more than 85,000, and you'd probably easily say probably double that and maybe triple that. I mean, we've had a threefold increase since the late 60s, 70s, and I think we could have another threefold increase. But right now, it's tough to find. As Scott's saying, 35 kilometers. I mean, we're sitting in my office, and there's a Montana Unlimited Bighorn Ram that I saw on winter range, and I took him 30 miles away. So that's not 30 kilometers. That's 30 miles away.
You got an unlimited sheep?
I did.
Really?
That's an unlimited sheep.
It's a big unlimited sheep.
It's a 13-and-a-half-year-old unlimited sheep. Like to kill me.
Hold on a minute. You found that same ram 30 miles from where you got him?
We found that same ram. You know, a blind hog can find an acorn every once in a while.
That's a big unlimited unit ram.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, that's the exact. On the front of my door, I have the live picture of that ram. I had a photograph in winter range of that ram on my desktop on my MacBook for 9 months, and we found three rams in a different unit, and one of them was that guy. One of them was bigger.
That's the nice thing about sheep is you can really, because they don't lose, right? They got a horn, they don't lose.
He's got three chunks of character. Now, I need to preface in case, your audience thinks I'm a great sheep hunter. I had a great sheep hunter with me. I actually had Kevin Hurley, our conservation director, now our vice president of conservation. He was kind of our camp jack, and I had the ace in the hole. Jack Ashton Jr., who I think has sheep blood running through his veins, was with me. So he and I backpacked up in, and we found the ram. In Montana, you got to get out of there in 48 hours. You've got to present a full head and cape within 48 hours to Game and Fish or Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And we got to the biologist in 48. After a bivouac and... A
lot of hoofing.
Yeah, just all the things you love.
Huh.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But the point, I realize the point you were making is just the distance is covered.
Yeah, that ram covered 30 miles, and that was just standard for that ram.
And he didn't do it by going in a straight line.
No. Now, the good news is in that unlimited area, there's no more domestic sheep.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was in the Stillwaters, Unit 500, and those sheep are relatively clean. And relatively hardy, but they still have some resident pathogens in them. But they're living with it. The problem is you then bring domestic sheep back in there, and they bring in another strain of Mivovi, and that's the ticker. That's the straw that broke the camel's back, and then you get a die-off again.
So let me hit with this question. Now that we've kind of like prodded around what the future might look like and what's acceptable, do we right now know that at least it won't get worse?
I don't, there are some, and I didn't answer your first question.
Well, I am going to answer.
Well,
you
that,
are
going to
do it. Okay,
yeah,
I even gave you out by saying
because,
you can't
no,
answer it.
there's those within our community that think that status quo is success.
Okay.
Wild Sheep Foundation, at least from my perspective, is not going to accept status quo as success. We want to come up with some more unique solutions to this problem, and they're out there. While I was in Washington, D.C., I had a beer with that domestic sheep producer, and in Nevada, they took a little different tact. They were basically willing to accept more risk. Some states would be willing to do that, others would not.
I don't follow what you mean.
So here's a scenario. Are we willing, if we can work more on the Mivovi free, if we can work with producers on better practices, is our community willing to, let's say in Montana, translocate wild sheep into areas that typically we would not, because we're fearful of that the disease transmission? And that's a big question we're facing right now.
So, like, are you willing to spend the money on it?
Are we willing to spend the money? Are we willing to not litigate with a producer because that producer didn't object to us moving wild sheep within, for argument's sake, 20 miles of this operation?
So you're making a sort of truce.
It's an organization wide question. It's a community wide question, and there's those that agree with it, those that disagree with it. But would we then set up protocols that, you know, we know that if that bighorn goes on a walkabout, that bighorn's not going to make it? Or do we use unlimited areas as a way to separate bighorns from domestic sheep? Are there areas, and, you know, this is again a kind of a Montana unique scenario, can we use almost no-go zones for bighorn sheep? If a bighorn sheep is in that zone, it's unlimited. You can take it.
Gotcha.
You know, we're just trying to think out of the box.
No, I'm with
try
you.
Try to think out of the box. Again, let's get past this doing the same thing and just fighting over this. The good news, and I guess why I'm optimistic and realistic but optimistic, is we are learning more and more and more on the disease issue. If we can get the domestic sheep industry to spend as much money as we do on disease research, that will help their industry, because there's some the data that show that, you know, Imovie is not good for domestic sheep either. It's endemic to them and it's resident to them. But it's not. Besser did one study. I think he was looking at the live weight, and it was like a 7% increase, and then it changed. So I, you know, probably shouldn't use those numbers. But there was a kind of a significant weight gain change between an Imovie-free domestic sheep and an Imovie-positive domestic sheep. The Imovie-free gained weight quicker. Well, then there's a market incentive. Yeah. So maybe there's some, you know, something that we can learn there. We're not there yet. It's unproven. It's not published. It's not peer-reviewed. But maybe there's something there. But, you know, wouldn't that be cool if we can use market incentives to encourage domestic sheep producers to, you know, if they can, have Imovie-free sheep, like pretty much eliminating smallpox, maybe there is some sort of silver bullet where we can vaccinate domestic sheep and they're all Imovie-free. We got two bright guys in the room, Scott and Clay. You know, I'm just a managing guy and a marketing guy. But, you know, there's some very bright people out there that are working on this issue. We've got the wildlife vet community working on it. There's not consensus on what the solution is, but you know what? We haven't cured the common cold yet either, but at some point we might.
But you have an interesting point there about producers being incentivized to get ahead of the problem. And Giannis and I had an interesting conversation one time with Wyoming's current governor, Matt Mead, where he was just talking about sage grouse in the extraction industry. And he was saying many players in the extraction industry have a very long view and they're very sophisticated. And they know that, like, for them to be on the ground doing good business, they need to head off problems. And a problem that they have a vested interest in heading off is not letting wildlife get into dire situations where you're going to then invite high-level scrutiny into practices, and that what's good for them to operate in their area would be good sage-grouse numbers. And that they can at times be very effective players when they have that long view and not heading into conflict, heading into disaster, courting litigation.
Great parallel.
But you just have, but again, you have to be in it for the, you have to be looking to the future, to 10 years profit,
right?
Not tomorrow's profit.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a really good point. I'm optimistic. We've made a lot of progress in wildlife disease and, you know, disease in our domestic livestock. If you think some of the things we've gotten out of our domestic animals over the, you know, centuries that we've been doing it, I'm optimistic that we can, if we put the shoulder to this one, I think it can, we can overcome it. I hope. I'm really hopeful.
I think the fact that you're, you know, honestly, Steve, you're here, like, that's a reason to be optimistic, because this was something that wasn't really talked about a whole lot, you know. And you get these guys that have incredible influence on the community, you know, and understanding really what we're up against. You know, imagine this issue flipped onto the elk population.
Oh, be different, you know, be a different,
totally different story. Yeah. And why? Because, you know, North American model is a huge success largely because of opportunity to hunt. You know, relatively low opportunity to hunt wild sheep, relatively low funding for conservation. That's where we come in. If it was elk on the same landscape, man, this wouldn't even be a discussion. You know, could you imagine if 20 bull elk came down into a domestic sheep herd and they mowed down those 20 bull elk just because they came in contact with them?
Yeah.
No way.
There'd be a different conversation.
No way. And so the almost what makes them so aspirational, like, you know, it's so difficult to get a tag, it's so difficult to get to their habitat, the things that make them so aspirational can also impede them on making them relatable to our everyday lives and understanding what's going on. If we see a die-off at 14,000 feet, we don't really take heed to it, and it's not something that impacts our freezer. We don't think it does. But we talk about wild sheep being 1.5 million, you know, almost double what elk are today. Imagine if they were. Imagine if it was something that you just, you know, you went down to Bob Ward's and bought yourself a tag and went sheep hunting.
Yeah.
Like
you have a lot more advocates. That's an interesting point that Callahan brought up after being at the sheep show. Was he was kind of marveling at the amount of people that are spending so much time, so much money, so much energy getting behind sheep conservation. And he's like, the thing of it is, most of those guys are never going to draw a sheep tag. They're just doing it
because
for the idea.
You know, something
they
do,
for the idea of it.
A lot of the chapters that they do, it's pretty fun. You know, you sit down at the banquet and they say, all right, stand up if you've taken a sheep. And it's like maybe a fifth of the room.
Yeah.
But people are going to spend thousands of dollars every night because they just believe in it. It's just out of their grasp, but they believe in it enough. You know, it's just this aspirational thing that we almost can't imagine going after.
I would say that we have the most altruistic membership in our community. I mean, we've got 7,200 members. Steve, last year we put $4.6 million into wild sheep conservation.
Is that right?
$4.6 million. $18.1 million in the last 4 years. With a little small 6,800 to 7,200 member organization. Clay worked on a project a couple years ago, and we were looking at it, and it's kind of switching gears a little bit, but it looks at the auction tags, and those are a little controversial.
Oh, we spend tons of time giving both sides of that argument.
Yeah, those are a little controversial.
I see both sides of that argument.
You bet.
With crystal clarity.
Should we jump
but
into
you,
that
but
right
you,
now,
you look. Bit? Let me give you some facts when it comes to wild sheep conservation.
Please.
74%.
Can I first explain what you're talking about?
Yeah, please do.
All right, we've talked about this 1,000 times. People always ask us about this. But when you have, I'm speaking for the listeners right now, when you have a resource that isn't large enough to meet the demand on the resource, you have to find a way, and I'm talking about a wild game resource, you have to find a way to allocate opportunity, right? And so if you live in the great state of Michigan or Wisconsin and you want to go deer hunting, there's enough deer to go around, everybody goes down, you buy a deer tag, everybody gets to go. With a lot of wildlife species, there's just the numbers aren't there. And so everyone throws their name in a hat and it's meant, you know, I shouldn't say meant to be, but traditionally those opportunities are allocated democratically. An exception to that case would be what you're going to now explain, which would be when they take tags, usually for very coveted species or coveted hunting areas, and they take tags and sell them to a highest bidder. And here's the rub. Here's the thing you got to pay attention to. And it's usually structured in such a way that like 90% of the money goes into the ground for restoration work. So it's not lying in someone's pocket. And this is a carefully watched flow of money. So
you bet.
With that little bit of bad, because a lot of people don't know what we're talking about.
It's a great setup, and if I could expand on it, you know, Shane Mahoney's a great friend, and he and I give talks around, you know, the world, and he was listening to some of my talks on this tag thing that we're going to talk about, the special permits and tags, you know, where exactly what you said, where, you know, one or two or five. Special licenses are taken from the pool of available tags and sold to the high bidder. And I used to call that a bastardization of the North American conservation model.
You used to.
I support it.
I never even went that far.
But I called it a bastardization. And I had Shane Mahoney down in my drift boat. We're floating down the Yellowstone River and we're, you know, probably enjoying a beer, in Shane's case, a Guinness. And he was just having a good time. He goes, "Gray, I want to taste."
Can you say it the way? Can you use his accent?
No, I'm trying to get the voice of God, Mr. Shane Mahoney.
There you go.
Great guy. Good. Absolute fabulous conservation. But he says, you know, Gray, you know, I've listened to you say this a number of times in a number of places that, you know, this special permit and tag, and it could also be a raffle tag, and we'll get into that. But this special permit and tag is a bastardization of the North American model.
He's saying to you, I've heard me say this,
and okay, I'd even use capitalism, socialism, kind of our standard system is an egalitarian program, and you know, Steve, as you put it, I mean, anyone can go down and get a tag. When it comes to some of the coveted ones, whether it's a bighorn sheep or a stone sheep or a desert sheep or a Rocky Mountain elk in a particular unit in Utah, you can auction off those tags too. So now that's not egalitarian. That's,
I want to interrupt to throw a piece field of color in. I apply for a bighorn sheep tag every year in 6 or 7 states.
Good for you.
And in this state in particular, for 15 or 16 years in a row, and I haven't gotten one. Just right, to give a sense of like what we're talking about, when we talk about the slim pickings.
You got the slim
pickings on tags.
You got guys in Montana that have been applying for 35 years and have not drawn a tag. So, you know, you're either lucky, or you go into a jurisdiction like Montana that has the unlimited use. Yep. But, you know, we had a 3-4% success. But so we're on the river, and Shane goes, you know, Gray, and he is, you know, he and Valor's guys are probably the foremost authority on the North American model. He says, you're actually wrong. It's not a bastardization of the North American model. The North American model also is one of its 7 pillars, gives the state the opportunity to decide how it funds wildlife conservation in that state. And so a state that decides, like Montana, that we will take out of the pool of bighorn sheep permits one auction tag and one raffle tag, and the key there is one goes to the high bidder and the very affluent.
One out of a couple hundred.
But I think we have 150 tags or so. So, you know, one goes as an auction tag, and one also as a raffle tag that, you know, so us regular folks can, you know, buy a raffle ticket and potentially have a little better odds than you've been in for 13, 14, and some people 35 years. So here's the interesting thing. When it comes to wild sheep, and Clay led this study with an intern, 74%, and I'll say that again, 74% of WAFWA, Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, the Western agencies in United States and Canada, 74% of their wild sheep conservation agency dollars comes from either an auction or a raffle tag.
Is that right?
74%. Now,
so you're peeling, like, let's say 2 tags out of 100 plus tags, right, and those 2
provide 74%. In a state like Arizona, it's about 95%.
Is that right?
And the other thing that was interesting in this research, and we used WAFWA data, 40% of all WAFWA wild sheep conservation agency dollars comes from one organization, and that's the Wild Sheep Foundation.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a very relatively small footprint when it comes to membership at 7,200. We cast a very, very long shadow when it comes to conservation and putting money on the ground. But, you know, there's sensibilities. Wyoming gives 5 tags away on auction. If Wild Sheep Foundation went to Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the commission and advocated for another auction tag, our building would be burned down. So, you know, it is controversial. But
check this out, man. I put it to my brother, or I, another guy put it to my brother in a conversation. And my brother, like, there's nothing he likes more than just, like, wrestling with ethical questions. So they put the governor thing to him. And he was saying that he feels, on auction tags, he feels that in balancing the morality of it, or in balancing the ethics of it, you need to look at what are the impacts of the auction tag. Because the auction tag is going to remove an animal from the landscape. But the money, if well spent, is probably going to add a higher number of tags to the general pool by the habitat work and relocation work and putting more sheep on the ground. So that money might be pulling a sheep out of the pool and returning four or returning five or returning 10. So there are actually possibly more tags made available thanks to the auction tag than in spite of the auction tag.
He nailed it. You know, we were talking about that unlimited ram. I can assure you, and we were looking at some data back in 2014. We've changed the dynamic in Montana now. Now there's an application fee of $50. But the amount of sheep revenue coming into Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks on the unlimited tags and the limited tags was less than $200,000.
Okay. And the auction tag
it was actually a lot closer to $100,000, around $120,000, $140,000. You can't pay a biologist in a truck and, you know, uniforms and the like on $140,000. You know, that same year we sold the Montana tag for $315,000. We've sold that tag as high as $480,000. And you pointed it out earlier, 90% of that money goes right back into Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in a dedicated sheep account. So we retain 10%. Well, we spend a hell of a lot more than 10% back in Montana. So 100% of those dollars go right back onto the ground into wild sheep conservation. In Arizona, it's 100%. Wild Sheep Foundation sells that tag. We spend $1 million to put on a show to get somebody crazy enough to spend $300,000 on a desert sheep. Bighorn sheep tag, and 100% of that dollars goes back to Arizona Game and Fish into a dedicated account to restore bighorn sheep and conserve bighorn sheep.
And that probably includes some disease spending.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Same thing,
man,
in the
I'm like tipping more and more every year.
Yeah. So
I tip more and more in the direction of, like, it's just like one of those, it's one of those things you want to be like, yeah, man, I see where you're coming from. I'm not digging. And you might, I'm not even asking you to aesthetically like the auction tags. Like, I'm not asking you to like the aesthetics of it, but it's almost like you cannot argue with the efficacy.
You know, and I getting back to that unlimited, I know that I had, as a regular guy, you know, a nonprofit employee, as a regular guy, I had the opportunity to buy, in effect, a bighorn sheep. I was living in Wyoming at the time. I was able to buy a bighorn sheep tag in Montana for $750 back then, in 2014, as a Wyoming resident, and hunt bighorn sheep in Montana. And I was able to do that only because some other crazy guy, gal, whatever, had the wherewithal to spend $350,000 on one tag. And that money went to ensure that I had an opportunity to hunt in Montana. So I look at it, you know, it can be unseemly. I look at it a little different. I look at it as, I am grateful that there are people out there that could give money to their alma mater. They could give money to cancer research, and they do. But there are those that have the wherewithal, and they give it to wild sheep restoration and conservation. So instead of vilifying those folks, I celebrate.
Yeah, but we can't measure their motivation.
Oh, you know, I mean, you can't eat horns.
I don't, you know, I think, Steve, the way that I've said it, you know, a lot of us like to say hunting is conservation is a term we use a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's any better depiction of that, honestly, than those auction tags. When you take one tag out of the whole pool that funds 70 whatever percent of that conservation of that species, you know, hunting right there is conservation.
Yeah. The numbers are, yeah. The numbers are.
You're struggling with this.
I'm not. Because here's the thing. Here's what I like to do. I like to take. In wrestling with an idea, I like to take it to the extreme, because one might come in and say, "Well, wow, man, that's a lot of money. Let's take all the tags and auction them off, because that'd be a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, then
at which point I would say, well, now I feel as though you have, right? So we all agree that there's like, that's not a tenable solution.
Right.
So we all agree that somewhere in here, there's a line, right? And we're like trying to like identify the line. Now to have a state do one, that's pretty damn conservative.
Yep.
Right.
Do you guys have numbers on how much the raffle tag brings in?
I don't know if Garrett, you have that. You know, Montana, it's typically a little shy of $200,000.
Oh,
yeah, but it's significant. I mean, it's significant.
You know, and that's five bucks a pop, right?
You know, the auction tag is the main player. But you know, I probably hip pocket would be a. I wouldn't want to say a 2/3, 1/3, but. You know, maybe 60% of the money comes from the auction tag, 40% from a raffle.
Have you guys ever calculated this out?
That's pretty good.
I think my brother,
less.
Yeah, my brother ran the numbers out. I can't remember if he was confident in it. Is if the raffle tickets are $5, how much do you need to spend on raffles before you're doing better than just applying for the tag?
Yeah, just kind of.
I think it was a surprisingly low number.
Yeah.
Where like your odds of getting the tag increased like $25 yeah. or something like that. Yeah.
No, the raffles, you know, bunch our community of chapters and affiliates. I mean, that's, you know, a raffle is so much better odds than any of the state or provincial. If there's an LEH in a province, but you know, any of the LEH drawings, a raffle's a much better odds.
They're just throwing into the state draw. I mean,
you're better off getting it. You know, if you're an aspirational sheep hunter.
And we all are.
And, you know, get into these raffles or, you know, we've got, you know, the gratuitous plug, but we've got the Less Than One Club, which is an organization or club, if you will, within Wild Sheep Foundation, where for $25, if you have not taken a wild sheep ram, for $25, you're entered into a drawing for 3 doll sheep hunts that we give away at our convention. And we've got 900 or so, 1,200 or so in that club within Wild Sheep Foundation. You got 3 chances. We spice it a little bit, Steve, because the first drawn, you don't have to be present. The second drawn, you got to be present. And the third, you got to be present to win.
Gotcha.
At this last Less Than One Club reception, and a reception's maybe a...
one of our colleagues drew one of those.
Yes. Yeah, he did. And but that reception's maybe not the... It's basically a beer fest. We went through 25 kegs of beer in an hour and a half.
For 3 sheep tags.
For 3 sheep tags.
8 kegs per tag.
You bet. So, you know, we... Maybe our community is kind of a drinking club with a sheep hunting problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really cool. I mean, the energy in that room is absolutely electric. And, you know, when someone that has aspired to be kicked out of the club, and that's what we say, hey, you join the Less Than One Club hoping to be kicked out, and you're kicked out when you take a ram, you know, we're giving away opportunities for relatively low dollars. And trying to augment the state and provincial drawings that are pretty low odds.
My buddies, I've been saying how after many years, I'm saying how I'm like taking a break from SHOT Show. And I say to my buddies, and I'm going to spend a couple years at a couple other shows. And I've brought it up with multiple of my friends in the hunting industry. And they universally are like, dude, cheap show.
It's fun. It's a family. You know, you know, we talked about the altruism, but what's cool, and I think there's a little bit of a misnomer about who we are, because, you know, the talk comes about, and I threw the numbers out, you know, $4.6 million last year with a relatively small club. So the erroneous assumption is that, it's just a bunch of rich folks. It really isn't. The demographic of our show is the age is going down and down and down because it's, you know, there's something badass about hunting sheep.
Yeah.
There's something badass about wanting to hunt sheep. There's something badass about training to hunt sheep. So we're seeing our attendance age go down and down and down. We have backpack races indoor, backpack races outdoor. You know, it's just a fun time. But what was interesting, and I had a guy come up to me, and it was actually at the Less Than One Club this year, and he said, you know, I'm sitting here, there's 1,500 people in this, because now we let anyone go into the Lesson One Club. You don't have to be in the reception. You don't have to be a member. And people, I mean, guys that have taken 27 sheep come into the Lesson One Club just to see how cool it is for some new aspirational woman or man win their first sheep hunt. The first drawn is a female mountain climber that's dating a sheep and moose guide in Alaska, outfitter in Alaska. And I mean, it was just fabulous when she won. She won an incredible Northwest Territories doll sheep hunt. She looks down at her boyfriend and, you know, she told me later, she goes, you know, I couldn't sleep that night. So I'm sitting there poking him, you know, in bed going, did you see what I won? So, you know, I mean, it's cool. And it's the family. But this guy came up to me and he says, hey, look, he goes, I go to all the shows, and I do too. I mean, I'm a member of all of the organizations. They're all great, and we support them. But he goes, you know, I walk around this room, and I have the feeling that there are some real big players in here. He goes, I feel I can talk to anyone in this room, and anyone in this room will talk to me. So, yes, you know, it's a great family, and there's something about wild sheep. You know, we talk about sheep fever. You know, we talk about it as being a sickness, but there's something about the places they live. There's something about how challenging it is to get up to where they live. It's something about the training that you have to do, the mental preparation. You know, and it's probably, and you know, Steve, you hunt in places that's just fabulous. And do it the right way, do it the hard way, and do it the way that we all aspire to hunt. But that's kind of the essence of sheep hunting. You know, you got to earn it. You know, it doesn't come easy. There's no easy rim.
Yeah, it's for the hard players.
It is.
Yeah. Steve, I spent my life on bighorn sheep, and I am a less than one member.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
I'm not.
You need to be.
Yeah, I already made a decision. We're going to the Wild Sheep Show.
I want to go this year. I'm going for sure.
And it's not on SHOT Show. It's February 7th through 9th, so we're off SHOT.
So I could feasibly. I want to spread my wings, man. I got to check some new stuff out.
Yeah, you'd love it.
I got to check some new stuff out. Any final thoughts around the table?
We're doing the whole
yeah, man,
thing.
If you want, holy, if you, holy, yeah, but yeah. If you feel that it's all been said, you can just say it's all been said. I don't have any concluding thoughts.
Oh, man. I'm, you know, as the preacher said, once I get started, generally I'm too lazy to stop. So I don't know if you want me to do that. But I, you know, I do think it's worth just mentioning, you know, Steve and Giannis, it means a lot having you guys here, you know, and helping us talk about, you know, what we do as an organization. The reality is we conserve a species that lives at 14,000 feet and that lives below sea level. And that includes a lot of animals along the way. So
that's a good way of putting it, man. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, I mean, when we do guzzler projects, a frequent animal that visits is a desert tortoise, right? You know, we just did a rehabilitation deal with encroaching conifers, and, you know, the guy, when we kind of got done, goes, well, actually, this is more mule deer habitat than anything else. But, you know, so we conserve that species, and we have to watch that chain of events happen all the way through those different elevations as they migrate. We have to watch, you know, just food, predator management, obviously domestic sheep conflict. And a lot of people don't know that that chain has to happen the whole way for this to work. And the fact that, you know, you guys are here and helping us tell that story, that just does good things for us.
Like helping sheep, you're touching a lot of wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, you're taking an animal that lives in the wildest places on both ends of the spectrum and probably one of the more wild animals in nature and behavior, and therefore you encapsulate a lot of critters right in the middle.
Yeah.
And so what we do, you know, it has legs. 40% of wild sheep conservation comes from us, and we conserve a lot of critters along the way.
Well put.
For me, you ask us if we were optimistic, and I am. I think a lot of times we focus on just the disease, just the negative side of the story. And if you look at the numbers, today you have a better opportunity to see sheep, to hunt sheep. My grandkids have a better opportunity to draw a tag. than I did when I started my career. That's important to me. I am confident that I don't know. I've been accused of being Pollyanna. I've heard someone said that to me once. But I'm confident that we can come to the table and try to think outside of the box, think a little bit different. Scott touched on it earlier. The science is improving. We're learning more and more all the time. But I'm confident that we will come together to find solutions. And I'm talking about both wild sheep advocates and the livestock industry to work together to achieve things that all of us benefit from. I'm confident that can occur. I just think the younger generation. I think they're smarter. I think they.
I don't know about that.
Well, I just think that the future is promising, and I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to where we came from. We've invested too much, blood, sweat, and tears. To be where we are today, and I'm proud of the Wild Sheep Foundation. I'm proud of what we do every day, and I'm proud to work for the organization. I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe in the mission, and so I'm optimistic about where we're headed.
And never got a sheep.
Not on purpose. I'll say it that way.
I understand what you're saying. Never got a sheep. Do you draw? Do you put in for sheep tags?
I do.
Huh.
A lot, like Steve, 13 Western states?
No, probably not that much.
I don't know if it's that many, but it's a handful. Yanni, you good? Or?
Can you guys answer this quickly? Because I heard a rumor. Are llamas bad?
Oh, that's the main thing sheep? I wanted to ask. Does my brother need to kill all of his llamas?
Camelids. Yeah, you know, we're not as worried.
No, just give it to me straight.
Yeah,
man.
We're not as worried about them. There's some new papers coming out. Clay, maybe you talk about, Scott, you can talk. I know Helen Schwanzi up in British Columbia is a little bit more concerned about them than we are. You know, it's kind of like pack goats. We're pretty concerned about pack goats, and you know, as we learn more and more, pack goats seem to be more likely MOV free than just a boar goat running around the so.
But llamas can carry it.
No, they can't carry they shouldn't be able to carry mycoplasma ovum pneumonia. You know, the ovum, you know, the ova. Oh,
why do people keep texting me to bust my brother's balls about hunting with llamas?
There's some potential disease risk there.
Yeah, and it's kind of like it's another rock that we got to and turn and just
see.
Gosh, now do we got to get involved with the llamas?
Even the pack goat industry thing. Pack goats are a big thing. We're working with the pack goat industry right now to develop some best management practices that we believe would work, that would involve some testing and other things. Kevin Hurley's actually meeting with those folks here.
Like you're distributing goat recipes?
No.
No?
No.
A good goat will do that.
Yeah. So anyway, the short version is, for us, at this stage of the game, it's not worth gambling with. We don't believe that it's worth a gamble.
I see. So.
Have your brother test it.
I will.
Yeah.
He can have his tested?
Absolutely. Just
he probably knows. He's not he's not a negligent dude. I just haven't talked about it with him lately. I'm sure that he's doing whatever he should be doing. And he's the kind of guy too that I think if someone laid out for him a really compelling case, I feel like he'd just be like, okay, I'm going to buy a horse.
Yeah.
Which is smarter anyway.
Well, he just doesn't have that background, man. People that grow up around horses, you can't catch them.
Yeah, his wife, who is a horse, I don't know. I don't want to say whisperer. That's
no,
weird.
She's like a horse master.
Horses almost every day.
Her dad grew up around horses. Her great grandfather.
She recommends that he does not get involved with horses.
Is this the brother that lives in Miles City?
Yeah, and his wife comes from a long, long line of horsemen, breeders, and ranchers. And she's recommended that he temperamentally needs to steer clear of horses. Yeah. Got something? Well, was that your concluder?
Yeah.
That was all?
Yeah. Thank you.
That's a good one because I forgot about that and that was top of mind.
Did we properly dodge it?
No, but it was enough. I got some code language.
We don't want to poke that one in the eye right now. We got enough.
You got bigger fish to fry, right?
I'll just rewind just a little bit.
Please.
If there's, there might be some listeners that are maybe a little confused about the setup, just some about the sheep ecology and the situation that we're in. So historically, sheep evolved in large metapopulations of well-connected subpopulations. So individual 2 to 100 size groups, right? So all these...
You're on domestics or bighorns?
Bighorn sheep.
Okay.
So they were, moving through the landscape, maybe ram groups going to breed different groups of ewes. And so we had this sort of network of connection depending on the habitat. Like, think about the basin and range in Nevada, those mountain ranges that jut up out of the desert. Sheep would go across those, right? So that's where, in modern times, we've got humans in the bottom, sheep, full year-round sheep habitat on top, they cross. That's where we're running into our problems. The river systems, they're traveling up and down. So their ecology and their evolution is to move in between groups. And so functionally, we want to manage for large groups of sheep rather than small, isolated groups, because there's all kinds of negative impacts of that. So we're kind of stuck in that problem where we're like, okay, here's a good piece of habitat, but we've got surrounded by domestics and we can't have sheep shooting out of it and going to talk to their friends upriver.
Okay.
So we've kind of gotten ourselves into a little bit of a pickle. And so that's
you mean
one
by a little bit of a pickle by thinking in pocket mentality.
Exactly.
Oh, we could have a few here, we could have a few there.
Yes, but they can't, but if they come out, we can't let them come out in the valley or we're going to remove them. So we've kind of got ourselves into a bind that way. But look at all this great sheep habitat we have and we want to have sheep there. But at the same time, it's hard to let them be sheep, because their natural tendency is to move around between groups and, eventually spread out.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point. In Texas, we built those populations, metapopulations. There's constant interchange between populations, and we've encouraged that because we haven't had the domestic sheep issues to deal with. So that's an excellent point.
Yeah, trying to restore that connectivity of herds, really, it's the pie in the sky, and it's right in WAFWA's main goal as far as connectivity and metapopulation management. That's the goal we're shooting for, not just to have one big population or one robust one here. We need a bunch of them that are all functioning together, exchanging genetic material.
That are talking to each other.
They're more resilient to disease outbreaks when you have a whole bunch of different scattered groups of sheep, and they're moving their genes in between, and it's the setup we need to go for.
And it seems to give you a situation to have localized disasters, horrible winters, and then hopefully get them back without needing to then have it be by a helicopter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was just one thing I think people might have missed out on if they're not familiar with sheep and how they've evolved.
No, that's a good point.
And it spans habitat types too, generally. And then I guess my little concluder is, we've had a great discussion today, and I thank you for having me. And a lot of the sheep habitat's on public land. So folks listening, if this hit strikes a chord, get involved. It's public lands, public wildlife. If you want to be heard, you got to be there, And a lot of these decisions are being made, policy level stuff that's disconnected from the science. And if you don't like it, you need to be there. And so that's my main point, is get involved.
Yeah, it's your sheep.
These are everybody's sheep, and we need to be there to make good decisions. And I hope that everybody listening will be able to someday draw a sheep tag.
Me too, man.
You've hunted all over the West. How many bighorn mountains have you passed? Sheep Mountain, Sheep Ridge, Big Sheep Ridge. Most of them don't have sheep.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
I think we need to get there where bighorns and sheep mountains are restored with sheep, bighorn sheep.
Yeah, if every sheep mountain had a sheep on it, we'd be in good shape.
Yep.
Yeah. So one last concluder.
One last concluder. Steve Giannis, first and foremost, want to thank you for the opportunity. I talked about Wild Sheep Foundation casting a broad conservation shadow. You cast a huge communications shadow. And a lot about what we were talking about today was education, and you've provided us an opportunity to educate a hell of a lot of people, and we're grateful. The final thought that I'd like to say is that, you touched on it on the extremes. There's an extreme on the right, there's an extreme on the left. and I've said this a few times to a few different groups, and I think it resonates. If we could concentrate, whether it's the non-consumptive community, the hunting community, the conservation community, the environmental community, the domestic sheep industry, the cattle industry, the you know whatever, and the wild sheep advocacy community, if we could aspire, work, and focus on the 80 to 90% that we agree on, and not spend all our time on the 10 to 20% that we disagree on,
yeah,
we can move mountains. So that's kind of our new narrative. Let's start looking at the areas where we agree and work on those and not bitch and moan and focus on the areas we disagree.
It's an interesting idea that you imagine a big room and everyone's in it and you make an announcement. If you think wild sheep are cool, come over in this room. And most people are going to wander in the room and then start there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Put our differences aside. Look for areas that we can work together, not areas that we spend all our time fighting.
Yeah. You can get a lot of work done in that space.
Bet. We'll put and keep sheep on the mountain. Wild sheep.
Yeah. Well, it's an admirable goal, man. I think that anyone who, you know, is up in some high, crazy mountain peak where you just kind of like happy with yourself for just having gotten up there, and to see one of those things crest out and turn his head and there's those curls, it's just magical.
Makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Yeah, it's like you're
there
seeing, touching, feeling wilderness. All right, well, thank you very much for coming on, everyone. I appreciate the time.